Hi, welcome to another segment on Focal Point. This is Stephen Thal, your host for today's Focal Point session. Today we have some very exciting guests, and they're going to be talking about elder abuse and prevention. We welcome Laura Stooning and Lilia Pustus. Laura, being an attorney, has some interesting responsibilities besides to being a general counsel for the Aging and Disability Services. She's also overseeing a couple of interesting programs, and one of them is an associate developer under the Aging Act. And can you tell us a little bit about that position?
Sure. Under the Older Americans Act, every state has what's called a legal services developer. And that's one of the roles that I fulfill. The job of the legal services developer is to ensure that older residents of the state have adequate legal representation. So I work with the Connecticut Bar Association, the Pro Bono Committee, Legal Services to develop and support those programs.
Okay, and you also co-chair the Coalition for Elder Justice as well.
Yes, correct. Myself and our state long-term care ombudsman, Mairead Painter, we co-chair the Coalition for Elder Justice in Connecticut. And it's a public-private partnership of professionals working to prevent elder abuse and also to promote the rights of older adults.
I want to talk to Lilia a little bit. You're a field representative, and you're in the Western Connecticut area.
Yes, that is correct. So within the state of Connecticut, we have 5 area agency on aging. And so I oversee the Western Connecticut region.
So are you saying that there is an individual field representative in the other 4 regions as well?
Yes. Okay. So every region within the state of Connecticut has a field representative that oversees the area agency on aging.
Okay. Why don't we talk about what is elder abuse?
Elder abuse is the willful infliction of physical pain or injury or mental anguish or willful deprivation of a caretaker of services which are necessary to maintain one's physical or mental health.
In terms of that definition, how do you document that?
Well, if there's a, and this is Laura, I'll hop in here because there is a process by which an individual who suspects abuse can report it. The way that it's typically reported is under the law, it requires that the Department of Social Services, Elderly Protective Services, is the agency within the state that accepts reports regarding elder abuse and does investigations of those reports. And there's several ways that you can do that, but the primary way to do that is to call Protective Services and make a report through their reporting line, which is 1-888-385-4225. And again, that number is 1-888-385-4225.
Okay, and what are the different forms of abuse?
Sure. So there's actually 5 that are very critical, if you will, for the time being that we're tracking and are prevalent. And so that is neglect, physical abuse, emotional abuse, sexual abuse, and financial abuse or financial exploitation.
What are the requirements to report an abuse?
So with regards to reporting abuse, typically what would happen is an individual would call Protective Services. They would reach what's called the central intake line, which is staffed by social workers. And the social worker would talk to the individual who's reporting and get details about what their observations were and why they are concerned. They would definitely need to provide as much information as possible because that helps the social worker with their investigation. But in order to do an investigation, they would need, at a minimum, they need the name of the individual that's involved and also their physical address. Typically, what happens if a social worker is assigned based on the report that's received, they would go out and do an unannounced home visit to visit the person and determine if the report that's coming in is accurate or not. So they would definitely need the person's physical address.
And they would use the same phone number that you gave earlier?
Yes, they would use that telephone number. And I can add that if there's a suspicion of abuse, they can also call after hours, meaning after regular business hours or on the weekend, they can call 211. Again, they would be able to call 211 for an after-hours report. And individuals who are calling from out of state, which sometimes happens if they have an individual has concerns, say, about a loved one who maybe lives in Connecticut, but maybe they're a family member that lives in another state, they can call 1-800-203-1234. And again, that's 1-800-203-1234.
If they have any questions about how to do this, is there someone they can call other than the numbers you already gave?
Yes, actually, they could call the State Unit on Aging's central intake number, which is, or I should say, we call it our must answer line, and that's 1-800-994-9422. And that number again is 1-800-994-9422. If they call that number and they need direction as to where to report abuse, we can point them in the right direction for that here at the State Unit on Aging. But for clarification, there are certain people called mandated reporters who are mandated by law to report suspicions of abuse within 24 hours. And they need to report those incidences to the Department of Social Services. And that was the Protective Services for the Elderly Unit. And that is the 1-888-385-4225 number that I provided previously.
What are you observing or what are you seeing in terms of elderly abuse for older adults?
I think one thing that we're seeing that is more prevalent than it was in the past is a significant uptick in financial exploitation of older adults. There is a very large increase in financial scams. The scams are much more sophisticated than previously, and so there's a lot of concern around that. And one thing that we try to stress with family members and with individuals who have been a victim of a scam is that it's not their fault. And I think there's sometimes a lot of embarrassment around it. So we want to make sure that people who may think that they have been contacted by a scammer and maybe they provided some information that they shouldn't have to the scammer, that they're okay and feel comfortable reaching out to get assistance with that. Because there are steps that can be taken to assist that person in protecting themselves going forward, stopping, say, for instance, withdrawals of cash from their bank accounts or whatever the situation is. It could be embarrassing, right? So we want to encourage people not to associate it with, oh, you're so silly, you didn't realize it was a scam. Well, these scam artists are very sophisticated, and any of us could be victims of scams. So if an older parent comes to you or an older person comes to you and says that they think that a scammer has gotten, say, their Social Security number or their Medicare number, you know, keep an open mind about that and don't blame that individual. It's the scammer's fault, not the older individual's fault.
Right.
It's very easy to fall victim to something like that.
Right. Is there a phone number they can call for scams to let people know or to feel more confident, you know, that they can work through the process?
Well, there's a few different options that they could take. And one of them is the Attorney General's office has an Elder Justice Hotline. The Elder Justice Hotline is manned by attorneys and paralegals at the Attorney General's office, as well as some volunteers who are older adults. Their telephone number is 860-808-5555. And the number again is 1-860-808-5555.
another good resource for information about frauds and scams, and I apologize, I don't have the number off the top of my head, but is the Connecticut chapter of AARP is also a very big advocate for older individuals, and they have a lot of information regarding scams, how to avoid scams, how to recover from financial exploitation. So I would go to their website. They have a lot of videos and articles that are very helpful and address that issue.
I'd like to talk to Lilia and see if she can tell us a little bit more about the Area Agents on Aging, what that's all about, and how she coordinates that for the older adults.
So there's federal and state funding that we have, and that funding is then allocated to these five organizations. And they are the ones that are the boots on the ground providing the services, whether that's nutritional, preventative health, caregivers, transportation to and from senior centers, any kind of services, any type of services that an older adult may need or is in need of. It goes through the agency Area on Aging. So myself and the other four field representatives, we oversee the operations that the services that are being delivered and the operations that take place at these five regional organizations to ensure that they're meeting their performance, but also delivering the service delivery, that they're delivering the services that they are projected to do.
Are you finding a difference between the regions in terms of the types of services being offered?
Absolutely. I think it all depends on the demographics. Every region is different. So some of the services, you know, one region that's more rural, if you will, needs more transportation. Hartford, for example, may need more translation and more assistance with filing various applications, whether that's disability or choices or transportation. So it all depends on every region's needs and vary based on the demographics of that region.
And now, I think one of the important things is connection would be the senior centers, wouldn't it?
Absolutely. And we are, as well, ourselves and the AAAs within the five regions, they're connected. They have partnerships and liaisons with the senior centers, and they're very active in connecting the older adults with the senior centers and the services that they provide.
Okay. Can you tell us, Laura, about the co-chairmanship of the Coalition on for Elder Justice is about?
Sure. The Coalition for Elder Justice is a organization that was developed back in the early 2000s. It was started informally by private entities and then received a grant and was more formally run starting in 2013. And the goal of that organization is to bring together both private entities in the community that work with older adults and public state agencies or even municipal agencies. So it's a partnership between private entities and government entities to better work together to prevent elder abuse and promote elder rights. And so some of the initiatives that I have worked on have involved, you know, training for attorneys to advocate for individuals living in nursing homes. We have worked on just general networking events to allow professionals to connect so they can better serve their clients in their communities. We're sponsoring the IAFCI conference, which is the International Association of Fraud Investigators Association, because financial exploitation is such a big issue right now. We felt very passionate about sponsoring them and supporting them in their efforts to combat financial exploitation. While it's a more of a professionals entity or a professionals group, our real focus is on, you know, bettering the lives of older adults and providing a more secure, safe place for people to grow older in Connecticut.
I'm pleased to see that is happening because, as you mentioned, we've been hearing a lot about the scams and the people doing it are becoming so much more sophisticated, even to the point of if you're on the computer, they can take your relatives' voices and make it sound like it's them and it's not.
Yeah, exactly. And that's going to make it even more important, I think, for everyone to recognize that it's not their fault if they have come across a scammer and they're approached by a scammer and say they provide information. I think there's been a lot of shaming around that. It's not the victim's fault. So I think we have to change the narrative around that so people will feel more comfortable coming forward.
Now, do you have social workers that can help with that or other staff-type folks?
So the State Unit on Aging doesn't have the social workers. However, you would be well served by contacting the Area Agencies on Aging. We work with the Area Agencies on Aging, and they are, as Lilia said, the boots on the ground people. They're the ones that are working directly with individuals to work on some of these issues. People can also contact Elderly Protective Services, even if they are the individual that has been maybe abused. You know, if they've been a victim of financial exploitation, an individual can actually call Protective Services sort of on themselves and say, hey, I've had this issue. Can you help me out? And a social worker from Protective Services can go out or at least give them some resources to help them through that process.
We're interviewing Laura Stooning and also Lilia Pastas about the elder abuse among older adults. I'd like to also look at how about the prevention side of it? Is there a lot of work being done with that?
Yes, there is, because prevention is the key to stopping elder abuse. There is a lot of work, obviously, on the side of responding to elder abuse, but I think education is the key around prevention and educating the public and educating professionals about how to recognize some of the more subtle signs and symptoms of maybe someone who's being abused and being able to recognize that and then knowing where to report those observations if they have a suspicion that there's some abuse going on.
Now, looking towards the future, what do you feel are some of your challenges in each of your areas?
Right off the top of my head, I think the biggest challenge is that we have an aging society. You know, we've been talking about it for several years that the baby boomers are getting older, and we are actually in the midst of that. We do have a lot of older residents, and it's a fact. But I think, again, education, to make people aware that elder abuse is a thing and that there is a place where it can be reported, is one step to try to prevent it before it happens, but also changing the way that we look at older adults just generally. I think there has been society older adults as maybe not as valued as, you know, other members of our society, and I think that because of that, there's not the policy and procedures in place to ensure that older adults are able to age comfortably in the state of Connecticut. And so I'd like to see us all kind of refocus and put a new lens on how we look at older adults, because we are all going to be older one day. So it doesn't just affect somebody over a certain age. It affects all of us.
How do you feel that the younger people are handling their parents? Like, the younger kids have gotten computer skills and some of our parents have not.
I can relate to that because I have older parents who are not interested in becoming technologically savvy. And so I do think we're sort of at a juncture in society where we have individuals who are comfortable with computers and different technologies, and we have others who are not. And there's definitely some advantages to having technology as part of our lives.
Right.
I think the main thing that I think about is for younger people to understand, and they may already understand this, is that the social connection, although you may have technology, the social connection is so much more important when you're working with anyone. We saw during the pandemic a lot of social isolation and behavioral health or mental health issues as a result of that. I would hate to see society rely too much on technology. that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
And remember the importance of the one-on-one connection and being patient with, you know, an older person who may not be either interested or able to participate with technology. Maybe they're not comfortable with it. Maybe it's not something that they want to do, and that's okay. So we have to respect those preferences and also be patient with one another.
Very true. There was a recent program on the news about that relationship between the parents who are aging out and the younger population as to how they're communicating or not communicating, and how do you bring them together?
It takes some effort, but it's definitely something I think we have to keep, and I have to do this myself, is to remind myself, you know, that that's not their, maybe their preferred mode of communication isn't texting or emailing. So you have to make that extra effort to stay in touch with one another.
Right, right. Good points. Lilia, what are you learning from the five regions in terms of the challenges faced by them?
I would say the main concern is that, well, two, I could come up with two. One is transportation, and the second one would be the connectivity between, again, a society that is so dependent on technology, and that divide or that disconnect, and being able to connect with, again, with the services that are needed or just your family. A lot of things, a lot of services are currently, you know, online applications or QR codes, and a lot of older adults are not able to, don't have that type of skill to be able to do that. And right. So there's that, there is that disconnect.
Because I'm also seeing that or hearing about it in terms of healthcare, where they put your health stuff on the computer. And
yeah, so
you need password. You know, people say to me, yes, I don't want any more passwords. I got 15 of them going right now.
Yes. And then you have to change them every couple of months
yes,
for security purposes. I wanted to echo back to what Laura was saying in terms of what are some of the challenges. And again, echo what she was saying, but also that this is not just a Connecticut situation. I think it's nationally, is that we're reactive rather than proactive. And our shift in mentality of how we're approaching this aging population. You know, what was prevalent and what worked 20 years ago with the demographics back then is not what's going to work going forward in the next 20 years. People are living longer. There's environmental factors. There's just many different factors that we need to take into account to plan better for a future.
I guess it starts with developing better communication skills, wouldn't you agree?
Absolutely. I think communication skills, as well as, like Laura said, it would be awareness and educating the community on the aging population, what services are available, what are the obstacles, what are some of the barriers, gaps in services going forward, yes.
Well, let's hope that many of the senior centers are able to come together, because I know Aging and Disability Services has somebody heading up that, correct?
Yes, we have a senior center coordinator. It's a new position that was approved in, I believe, the 2022 legislative budget. Her name is Claire Cody. For the first time, working on bringing together all of the senior centers and trying to strengthen what they're able to provide to the community and to their residents. The senior centers are wonderful places to connect older adults to services and different programming. You know, they've provided a great space for coming together and solving the issue of social isolation. So I know that Claire has a lot of different projects planned. You know, hopefully we'll be able to move forward, because senior centers are a really good place for older adults to get information, stay active, stay social. I know that senior centers are also looking to do, as we were talking about before, kind of change the way that people look at senior centers. I had a grandmother who was in her 90s, and I asked her why she didn't go to the senior center, and she told me because it was for old people. And, you know, even though I encouraged her to do that, I think there's a view or a perception of the senior center that isn't necessarily accurate. And so I think that we need to look at senior centers as a resource, and also encourage people who don't consider themselves old as a place that they can connect with other people who have similar interests, you know, it's not just bingo. So we want to really encourage people to go to their senior centers and look at them as a resource for information and socialization. They're so much more than I think what people perceive them to be. Yeah, I think senior centers are trying to broaden their offerings to people who are typically, I think senior centers serve individuals who are 55 and older, but they're trying to broaden their offerings to people to make it a more inclusive place where there are activities that would appeal to a wide variety of ages. If you think about it, the senior centers do serve a very broad age group, right? So you have potentially an individual who's 55 and someone who could be 105.
Yep.
That's a big age span to be able to serve. And so they have to diversify their offerings so they can attract more individuals into their centers and also avail them to all the information and services that they can provide to that person that they may not otherwise be aware of.
Correct.
So it's a really good place for people to connect.
Well, I know the senior center here in Wallingford several years ago built a gym, added a gym to their building, and it really made a difference for those that don't have access to a gym area.
Yes. There's a senior center in the eastern part of the state that has actually rebranded their name. It's the Groton Senior Center, and now they call themselves Thrive 55. And when you go to their website, you have pictures of people doing certainly indoor activities, but also because it's by the shore, they have pictures of people kayaking and they have kayaking trips. Yeah. So they're really trying to rebrand themselves so people look at senior centers differently.
I was involved with Gaylord Hospital, and they have about 17 different sports that they can help people with physical challenges. So they can call them and see about being evaluated and get training on it. I think it's amazing, and I think this hospital special care may have something like that in New Britain. But, you know, they keep telling you, and you're over 55, you got to keep moving.
Stephen, this is Lilia. I wanted to provide some statistics in terms of the various forms of abuse and just to give people a better understanding of how prevalent abuse and the various forms of abuse are. And so it's important to know that annually there is 5 million people abused. If you think of that, that is about 1 in 10 that will experience some or one form of abuse. 90% of cases of abuse cases occur in the victim's residential home. And those who have experienced some sort of abuse are 300% at a higher risk of death. And 65% of the victims are actually women. And only, this is the one that just blew my mind, but it was that only 1 in 24 cases are reported to authorities. And that's kind of going back to what Laura was saying earlier in terms of, you know, the guilt or the shame of telling a family member or a caregiver. The reason why that is only 1 in 24 cases is because individuals feel shame in you know, giving up their personal information or falling for that scammer or embarrassed to let a loved one know that they're experiencing some sort of abuse.
Yeah, and some of these abusers, and actually a majority of the abusers, unfortunately, are found to be family members.
Right.
And so if an individual is reliant on a family member to care for them, and that may be their only support, they are fearful that they're going to lose that caregiver, because that also means a loss of their independence.
Right.
To a certain degree. And so, you know, often we hear stories of abusers who will actually threaten an individual by saying, you know, if you don't do X, Y, or Z, I'm going to put you in a home. And we all know that no one really relishes the thought of having to enter a nursing home for a variety of obvious reasons.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that's sometimes a threat that's used with an individual who is being abused by maybe a family member or a friend or an acquaintance who's in their life and doesn't have good intentions. So, you know, they're afraid. If the abuser is a family member, it's also their family member. So if it's a son or a daughter, niece or a nephew, or anybody in their lives, that's still somebody that they care about and love. And so it's not as easy to say, yes, I want you to call the police or I want you to call protective services and have them, you know, arrested, because they still care for that person. So it can be a very complex situation. I just wanted to bring up that one last one in terms of financial exploitation, top reporter of the various forms of abuse. And currently, the annual loss by victims of financial abuse is at $36.5 billion. So just to give you an idea of how prevalent, how, like Laura said, how sophisticated and ever-evolving scammers and the predators, if you will, when it comes to financial abuse.
And just to follow up on what Lily is saying, and, you know, one of the things you think, oh, well, that's a lot of money for sure. But one thing you have to keep in mind is that that doesn't just affect that older individual. It affects all of us. It affects us as loved ones. It affects us as citizens and as taxpayers. If an individual is scammed out of their life savings, the result can often be that that person has to rely on federal and state assistance for the continuation of their life and to be cared for properly. And so they may have had the proper resources to take care of themselves into their older years comfortably, but if there's financial exploitation involved, you know, and they lose all of those funds, an older individual doesn't have the opportunity to go back and say, earn that income again, right?
Right.
So they have that inability to earn that money back. And as a result, they then become dependent on the state or the federal government for assistance. And that trickles down to everybody. When you look at that billion-dollar number, it's pretty shocking.
Well, we've come to the end of our program, and we want to thank you both for sharing these thoughts with us.
Thank you for having us.
First, thank you for allowing us into your homes, but remember to wear sunglasses and a hat when you go outside. The sun is very bright and very tough on our eyes. And secondly, in your own home, do an emergency plan. Plan it and then practice it, and involve as many people as you can in the home so they know what to do in an emergency. And when you're traveling, make sure you look for two ways to get out of a building, because that may save your life. Thank you all for tuning in.